like to thank Professor Gale for his kind introduction. In his usual modest way, he has refused to say that he is carrying on some of the important works that Paul Baran has done. His paper entitled The New Man in New China has established some theoretical basis for analysis as an alternative analysis to neoclassical economics, using China as the empirical framework. Professor Gurley is also vice president of the American Economic Association, and for a professor teaching Marxian economics at Stanford to be elected as vice president of the American Economic Association is an achievement of no mean task. My main task this evening is to introduce Professor John Robinson, who will speak on the topic, The Blight of Conventional Economics in the Third World. The second task is to briefly set the stage for her speech and also to briefly comment on what took on this afternoon. Paul Baran is an intellectual in the real sense of the world, of the word. He looked at the world of the underdeveloped countries and he theorized about it. Strangely enough, most of his work was done on the Stanford campus. But his work had more effects, far-reaching effects, across the Stanford campus. This afternoon, Professor Drake analyzed how Baran's work found its way to Ghana and was used during the revolutionary stage of the Nkrumah regime. Jack Gurley this afternoon also explained the contributions of Baran to the 1950s and also pointed out the limitations which Baran had in terms of not knowing too much about China, or that China hadn't matured to the stage in which it could be analyzed as of 1948. Professor Donald Harris also pointed out the descriptive nature of Baran's work and its perhaps lack of analytical content, whereas Peter Sen also pointed out that, in fact, Baran's work had a lot of analytical content. It was also pointed out that Baran's work set the stage for present work of the third world economies entitled The Dependency School of Thought. Now let me switch on and say one or two things about Professor John Robinson before making the formal introduction. I first met her while I was a student in Berkeley, and I was a friend of a cousin of hers. And when she was in Berkeley, she asked us to take her to Mendocino, which we did, and we wanted to take a hike. So we started off the trip. And we wanted to be nice to her, so we decided to run up and then run down while she kept on walking. But it was soon apparent that our running up and down was either making us tired or her pace was much faster than we thought. And she kept a steady pace, which she never reduced, and in fact she tired us out. It was later on that I found out that takes long walks in Cambridge, and as a matter of experience, she could challenge us to walk in any trail that we could. Yesterday, we went to Mendocino in the morning, visited a cousin who lived in the woods, and we spent 4 hours last night discussing Christianity, and she was much at home. Although the cousin is an economist, we didn't talk economics last night, but 4 hours on religion, and she was at home with the concepts of the Pentecost and everything else. So I would like to point out that Professor John Robinson a very erudite woman. She is important to the third world for a very specific reason. The reason being that she makes neoclassical economists very insecure. She developed the theory of imperfect competition, but has repudiated parts of it. And that I take it to be the sign of intellectuality. I would like to quote, one or two sentences from a passage here, which points out that neoclassical economics is not in concomitant with the historical facts. Karl Marx, in describing the way that the third world developed, had this to say: the discoveries of gold and silver in America, the extirpation of the indigents in some instances, their enslavement or their entombment in the mines, in the Indies, the transformation of Africa into a prison for the supply of the Negroes who were the raw materials of the slave trade, these were the incidents that characterized the closing down of the era of capitalist production. These were the idyllic process that formed the chief factors of primary accumulation. However, neoclassical economics does not take these historical facts into account. In 1865, a traveler in the then Gold Coast, now Ghana, had this to say: if we come to the interior 6 days' journey, people make iron and make their own clothes, but nobody thinks along the coast of making iron or clothes. Native industry disappears as far as the European trade is going. Thus, under the era of Western capitalist expansionism and the era of international or colonial division of labor, the third world countries underwent some structural transformations. And these transformations are not taken into account in analyzing neoclassical economics. It is in this light that Professor John Robinson is going to talk to us about the plight of conventional economics in the third world. She has written several books, among them The Accumulation of Capital, An Essay in Marxian Economics, The Economics of Imperfect Competition, Introduction to the Theory of Employment, Exercises in Economic Analysis, and lately she has been working chiefly on China. And working in the third world, I welcome Professor John Robinson very much to talk on this subject and to increase our insights into the problems of the third world. Thank you.
First of all, a great number of very brilliant students are caught in the third world countries and distracted from taking any interest in the problems of their own countries and taught to play these tricks with the production functions and all the fiddles and pedals of so-called mathematical economics. It is not mathematical, as a matter of fact, it's merely a fantasy. I mean, you can't do mathematical operations on a quantity unless you can say what the quantity of, because you find the unit, and the unit must imply its method of measurement. When you're doing mathematical operations on utility, or capital, or even national income, you're not doing mathematical operations at all because you haven't defined the unit and you haven't specified its method of measurement. So it's pseudo-mathematics, but it's very, very fascinating, of course. And for most level people, it's very enjoyable to be able to show off doing it. So here are people coming from countries where the economic problems are oppressive and serious and need to be understood. And they're taken away and taught to play these idle games. That's one element of the problem. But a more important element is that the doctrines which emanate from the neoclassical scheme are taught and made to influence policy in those countries. Now you might say it doesn't really matter what the economists say. The policies would be the same anyway. But I don't think this is entirely true, because there is an important influence in the intellectual elite in these countries. There is an important influence in the formation of policy. And the fact that they are continually being taught doctrines which are totally inapplicable to their problems is certainly harmful, not merely adding a respectable surface to what would have been done anyway. Well, the most obvious case of this is the doctrine of free trade. Free trade was the central core, the arc of the covenant of the old neoclassical economics, the Keynesian system. The hallmark of an economist was someone who understood that protection is harmful to all, in all circumstances. Now, this doctrine in the West has become very much attenuated. Keynes pointed out, for instance, that protection would increase employment for one country in the situation of a slump, although it would do so only at the expense of making the slump worse somewhere else. This doctrine is still very powerful. The theoretical basis of it is very narrow. It was derived from the case against protection which Ricardo made. And he took the example, you remember, of Portugal exporting wine and England exporting cloth. And he showed how the doctrine of comparative advantages taught that it would be a good thing for Portugal to give up protecting its textile industry and for England to give up protecting its wine industry. And he gives a nice little example and shows that this follows from the assumptions. The assumptions are in terms of static comparison. This very interesting book has been written about what actually happened in the trade between England and Portugal. The result of removing protection meant that the textile industry in Portugal came to an end. The textile industry in Great Britain flourished. In England, the development of the textile exports led on to the whole process of the Industrial Revolution and the development of export of pork from Portugal led to a very stagnant development of their economy. But this, you know, in the textbooks now, you don't even have Ricardo with cotton, with cloth and wine. You have two countries and two commodities, and the countries are all exactly alike. There's no difference in their comparative commodities. The only difference is in the endowment of the factors of production. And so, in this way, they've reduced the argument to a state in which it's completely naked, has even less to be said for it than Ricardo's example. But to preach to countries in the third world that they ought to develop their export of their natural resources and not try to foster industry, of course, is rather convenient doctrine for the already developed industrial countries which want to have a ready access to the supplies of materials and to the markets of these countries. So the countries, in fact, of course, realize that it's quite impossible for them to develop at all if they don't protect their industries and develop import substitution as the basis for development and so on. But they're made to feel guilty about it. And when they get into trouble with the balance of payments, which of course frequently happens to them, the IMF comes along and imposes upon them these policy of free trade and exchange depreciation as a way of getting out of their difficulties. Now, it's very transparent who gains from imposing this policy upon the third world countries. What actually happens with protection is illustrated by the story of this same industry, the British cotton textiles. The British cotton textile industry developed in the first place under protection against the goods which were being imported from India. But the Indian muslins were much superior to anything that could be produced in England. Well, then the Lancashire industry got through its teething troubles and began to produce successfully. And then didn't any longer need protection, and the Indian market was thrown open, and India was not allowed to protect her industry. The British government in India imposed free trade, and they believed in it to such an extent that even later stage, when the government of India had some fiscal autonomy, and they imposed a tariff on peace goods, simply to get revenue. And then they were obliged to put an equal excise duty on home-produced cotton so as to be fair and not to give them any protection. the argument, this system, first of all, of imports from Lancashire, and secondly, from some development of manufacture of industrial manufacturers within India, had the effect of wiping out practically entirely their indigenous handloom industry. It was not quite true, because at a later stage the industry somewhat revived on importing yarn, because the advantage in spinning of mechanical methods of production is much greater than weaving. Well, the hand spinning is here, but weaving revived somewhat at a later stage. the argument was used, in fact, I think I was told this when I was reading for the Triumphs in the 20s, that it's obviously the case that if the Indian public are buying the imported cotton in preference to their own indigenous production, it must be because they prefer it. And therefore, they are benefiting from having the open market and being able to buy the cotton from the cotton piece that's an edge. Now, it's important, I think, to analyze this argument, because superficially it seems quite plausible. If you have free trade, the manufactured goods can undersell the handmade goods, and the people want to buy them, well, they ought to be allowed to buy them. But looking at it from the point of view of the Indian economy, see, the advantage to the consumer is a little bit extra. The preference of the foreign goods over the home-produced goods is something extra. They prefer these goods, or they're cheaper, and so they have an advantage. But they have to pay the price of the home cost, of course. Over the handloom industry, which has disappeared, is a loss for the nation. And the gain is only just that little bit extra of the preference for the imported goods. But this way of looking at the matter, of course, is not allowed to penetrate the textbook arguments about consumers' choice and the benefits of free trade. Now, I think another very important confusion which is fostered by economic teaching, and that is the idea that capital is a factor of production. And what is necessary for development, for industrialization, is to have more capital. And if the foreigners come in and make investments in the country, or if governments give land, then the would-be developing country is getting some capital, it's getting a factor of production, and it ought to be very grateful to the dear kind capitalists who are giving them this factor of production. But what is the process of importing capital in this sense? What you are importing, looking at it from the point of view of the receiving country, you're getting some finance. It's money, it's loans which are being given. And this means that it's possible to have a deficit, a deficit on the balance of payments, without going bankrupt. It's what getting finance enables you to pay for some imports that you are not able to pay for with the proceeds of exports. Now, supposing that this, by taking the case of a direct investment, the foreign company is going to open a branch to exploit the market in this third world country. And so they first of all are providing some finance. But generally, they don't provide finance equal to the whole cost of the investment. But in many of these countries have now reached a level of development where they have a capital market of their own. So the foreign company can put in a little finance and then borrow by selling bonds in the local market. So the country doesn't even get the whole amount in terms of finance. Now this will partly be used to import ingredients which go into the investment. There's some machinery which can't be made in the country. It hasn't got its own iron steel industry. We'll have to import steel and so on. So part of the cost of the investment will be for imports. Now, the investment is a real investment. If you're importing ingredients, physical ingredients, which are going to go into the investment, this is a real investment. But the greater part of the investment, of course, must be made by labor locally. All the digging and construction work will have to be done by the locals there. So this is not being, the finance is not being used to bring in something which a country hasn't got. It's being used to organize the employment of labor on the spot. This employment is then creating the installation, the instruments of production, factories, whatever it may be, is being created by labor. And the foreign capital that's coming in is merely subscription to the import surplus of the country. And the import surplus is not needed for supplying this investment, which must be done locally, and therefore it's becoming available for importing other goods. And what goods are being imported? They'll be, generally speaking, the luxury consumption goods, which are not forming an ingredient in development of the country at all. On the contrary, are rather a drag on investment, on development, because once the wealthy class of the country gets a taste for foreign goods, this is going to reduce the resources available for investment. Well, now, going to Fiat, you see a factory, say, has been created. Some employment is, labor is given, and some goods are being turned out and being sold, and some profits are being made by the factory. And the capital investment, which has gone into setting this business up, is then belongs to the equity holders abroad. And the profits can then be remitted. So with this little bit of finance that you've had has been made available to the country, a little bit of finance has been made available to the country, has created a large amount of earning resources which then are obliged to remit profits. I suppose if the business is successful, making profits out of the home market by employing the home labor, you succeed in getting some more profits and the business is expanding. Well, that's all right. Now they are creating more resources in the country and employing more labor. That's fine. But then all this extra capital, which has been created out of the profits earned in this market and by the labor of the people on the spot, this again is capital which belongs to the equity holder abroad and which has to have profits remitted. So this is the process of importing capital. And the economics textbooks, which muddle up the concept of capital meaning factories and machinery, with capital meaning finance, are helping to promote this confusion and keep the people in the country in ignorance of what it is that's really happening. Now, all very well, but they are organizing employment in the country, they are producing some goods, perhaps the local people didn't understand how to produce them. All right, what are you complaining of? Well, the point is that this kind of investment will be oriented towards the most profitable market in the country. And so the contribution that it's making to development is not likely to be very great. You know the expression colonization. The first thing that comes in is a factor for producing Coca-Cola. Now, is that the most essential ingredient for a process of development and investment in the country? The mystification lies in the fact of pretending that what is profitable is the best contribution which can be made. What is most profitable is the best contribution that can be made to development. And this, of course, is the heart and key element in precisely in orthodox economics. Orthodox economics is the defense of laissez-faire, the defense of a system in which the free market is allowed to allocate resources between alternative uses. This is the central heart of the whole doctrine. And here you see it at work. the free play of market forces is allocating the resources of this country to producing Coca-Cola or producing washing machines for their wealthy class. This dissemination of a doctrine which is essentially the defense of laissez-faire in the countries which are supposed to be trying to plan their development, of course, is a very drastic contradiction. And it's from this contradiction that all the various aspects of this misapplication of ideas to problems arise. But what would be a useful plan of investment for this country? Here we come up to a very difficult question, the question of the choice of program and the choice of technique. The problem was discussed, it's being discussed this afternoon, the question of whether you ought to allow the importation of high capitalistic methods, mechanized methods of production, which is going to take away the market and take away employment from an indigenous industry. You already had the example with the indigenous cotton industry in India. There are many other examples. Kofi was telling me the story about the salt industry in Ghana, which used to employ a large number of people and had a large number of ancillary investments were required, and ancillary employment in transport, in making the canoes, and so forth. Well, they come in and introduce a mechanized plant which can supply the whole market and completely wipes out the indigenous industry, makes all these people unemployed. Oh, this isn't quite an easy question to see your way through, because the whole object of the thing, after all, is to increase productivity, to mechanize, to introduce industrial development. So, on which side does the balance lie? You don't want to make a museum in which these nice people in their canoes are going to go on producing salt and keeping a low level of productivity. This is the question. This is the point on which Maran had very strong views, and he was on the side of mechanization and development, because he was taking his model from the Soviet Union, and he hadn't got any patience with these people who were thinking of the loss of the indigenous industry and their way of life and employment. So here is a question which we need to think about. I think that the clue is to be found in the Chinese government, in their policy of walking on two legs. They have highly mechanized, quite slap-up modern industries installed, because their iron and steel complex is completely automated, fully much the latest thing, very high ratio of investment per man employed. And then on the other hand, they have people, say, pulling cards. See, even now, it's getting much less common, but even now you see sometimes a man and a donkey, sometimes a man without a donkey, pulling a cartload of vegetables into the town. So we have extreme difference. Some things with very high capital per man, and some things with practically no capital per man. And this obviously is the correct policy. There's no question this is the correct policy. You have limited investment resources. You should apply the investment at those points where it tells most. I mentioned already the difference between spinning and weaving, the difference between iron and steel production in a modern complex and the forgings which they produce on the communes. Yes, here are the difference to productivity which can be made by investment is absolutely enormous. In other things, it's very much less. So clearly the first thing is to look at your bill of goods. What is it you want to produce? This can't be decided for you by the market. This can't be decided by any mechanical calculation of prices. It's got to be decided by the conception of the plan. What is it you want to produce? What is your policy? And then you must look through the bill of goods and see where investment will make a big difference. And allow the investable resources to go first into those places where they make a big difference, and use your hand methods or your indigenous industry meanwhile. That gradually, Skyway will be able to mechanize everything. Everybody will be producing the kind of thing. Meanwhile, a great deal of work at a very low level of productivity will still be used, and something is better than nothing. So here is a way of seeing through this dilemma. And surely, with your younger case, you might meet the people in the canoes getting salt because the investment would be much more valuable in, say, machinery or some other lines that can go on with the low-level output per head methods until your development has grown so far that everybody can be given equipment. There are a great number of things which, if you just look at it in a simple, common sense way, you can see that these deep puzzles aren't really puzzles at all, but just really a matter of just deciding which is the best way to get through the problem. The Chinese have a remarkable combination of political philosophy with common sense. By this means, they find their way through these problems. But of course, this entails that the country has got command over its own resources and has got a clear view of what it wants to do. And this is, in fact, of course, completely lacking in those countries which are allowing themselves to be developed by the method of importing capital. They neither have command over the resources, they have to accept whatever the foreigners choose to do, and they haven't got a clear view of what they want. In fact, in most of these countries, a great division is growing up between people who are still living in the old style and finding their market taken away from them so that their income is actually falling, while there is developing a middle class who can get on quite well with the foreign capitalists, beginning to develop capitalism on their own and developing a standard of life which creates tremendous polarity between their way of life and that of the country. This polarity, of course, is being invented growing up in the Chinese. So there's a total gulf between current policies, countries which have really got command over their resources and got an idea of what they want, and the countries which are allowing resources to be developed by importing capital. Well, the basic problems of all these countries is first of all to think what they want. And this is the most difficult problem which lies before them. But of course, first of all, no country consists of a single will. There are different interests, different historical traditions in different parts of the country. There are those who already got some butter put on their paws by the foreign capitalists. There are those who are suffering because they haven't got any access to the market at all. So it should be, then, the intellectuals who bring their mind to bear on this question and try to formulate some conception of what development is, what they want, what they should go for. And it's precisely these people who should be the conscious, so to speak, of their countries, who are being led away with all this neoclassical economics, which is merely putting them into the position of being a hanger-on and a convenience to the capital.
China is unique and does not really characterize most of the less developed countries. I mean, it has a large internal market. It has most of the resources necessary for development. It seems like for the most majority of LDCs, development for them has to come through, you know, expanded trade, not self-sufficiency as China has achieved, is achieving development.
No, I don't think that's entirely true, because supposing that you have got an export commodity, then the proper policy is to prevent imports of any inessential goods. Use the policy of walking on two legs, that's to say, use your resources that you get from your export commodity to make investments which will develop the country, and don't allow any imports of inessential goods, anything that you could produce at home, any consumer goods which are not basic to the development. But I think that the fact that many countries have to depend in the first stage on their exports in no way should condemn them to following a policy of free trade.
Huh? In other words, you're saying that if a country needs, say, steel for development, it ought to be producing it? I mean, you don't believe in any sort of economies of scale or, I mean, it seems like the notion that, sure, a country like, say, the size of Jamaica could produce steel, they could probably produce computers, but the notion is that they'd have to be producing them in such a
way. What I'm saying is that they should not import. You see, the free trade doctrines tell them not to have protection, not to control their imports. A country which has developed during the colonial period has developed some export. Jamaica has bauxite, Ceylon has tea, West Africa has cocoa, and so on. Well, all right, go on, earning foreign exchange, but don't waste the foreign exchange on importing consumer goods, and particularly on importing luxury consumer goods. Use the proceeds to buy the steel and have a machine-making industry in the country. I mean, this is obviously the correct policy.
What would you say then are the effects of a foreign capitalized export industry such as petroleum?
I think there's another model very similar to China, and that's the case of, two models, actually, Mexico and Brazil. And I think especially Mexico, they've proceeded fairly well along the import substitution policies, which you are preaching, I believe. And today, they seem to be fairly self-sufficient in many areas. And I think that's another model which is going to grow in the future years.
Now, those two countries that you mentioned are very unlike China in the purpose to which they're putting their development. Because in China, the object of the development is to raise the standard of life and education and the capacity to produce of everybody in the country. And to maintain a very simple level of consumption until everybody is able to enjoy whatever luxuries there may be. Whereas both in Mexico and Brazil, there's a complete polarization of consumption. You have a small luxury class and a very large miserable class. So that although the policy has been quite clever in capitalist terms, the object is very different from the object of China.
I wonder if you would comment on the fall of output, which resulted in the most thoroughgoing application of walking on two legs. That is the great leap forward.
What fall of output? Sorry, I don't follow your mind at all. What output is
called? Well, as I understand it, there was a famine in China in 62 and 63 following the great leap forward.
Well, the story of the Great Leap was that it was followed by three very bad years of very disastrous weather conditions. Now, the Chinese, they have enormous failures.
We can.